From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, controversial topics with Michael Rivero. He's backed by popular demand. We're going to get involved into the downing of TWA Flight 800, the Kennedy assassination, election fraud, what's going on with the economy, and so many other stories. Full show in a moment with Michael Rivero next hour. Here's what's happening. Well, here's some good news. An appellate court has finally supplied an answer to an open question left dangling by the Supreme Court in 2012. And that question was, do law enforcement agencies need a probable cause warrant to affix a GPS tracker to a target's vehicle? That was the big question. Could law enforcement, many of whom listen to our program, did they have the right to put one of those tracking devices on a car with any probable cause? The Third Circuit Court of Appeals has given a resounding yes to that question today in a 2-1 decision, meaning it's a victory for Americans because it ensures that the police cannot use powerful tracking technology without court-ordered supervision. Finally, we win one. Two influential human rights groups say that they have freshly documented dozens of civilian deaths in the United States drone strikes, and that was in Pakistan and Yemen, contradicting assertions by the Obama administration that such casualties are rare. In Yemen, Human Rights Watch investigated six selected airstrikes since 2009 and concluded that at least 57 of the 82 people killed were civilians, including a pregnant woman and three children who died in a September 2012 attack. And you wonder why we were hated so much around the world. And these are the drones, by the way, that they want to put in the skies over us. 30,000 of them. The Department of Homeland Security is set to spend $80 million on hiring a number of armed guards to protect IRS and other government buildings in upstate New York during the public demonstrations and civil disturbances, once again prompting concerns that the federal agency is preparing for food stamp riots, anti-tax demonstrations, or some other form of domestic unrest. Paul Joseph Watson wrote this story for Infowars.com, Alex Jones's site. Let's check in with Jerome Corsi. He's the expert on just about everything. What are they getting ready for, Jerry?
Well, George, I think you've got it right. I mean, this is documented on the Federal Business Opportunities website, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, $80 million to hire New York private armed guards to protect IRS buildings. And most people are just unaware of it, George, but in November, the food stamps program is going to cut all benefits across the board.
Oh, boy.
By a decline, for instance, a family of four, which is now getting a benefit of $272 average per household, could get $36 less per month starting in November because of the expiration of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. The stimulus program has expired.
Well, we know they bought millions of dollars in ammo. And now yeah. They've got these armed guards. Maybe the ammo was for these guards, Jerry.
Well, George, it's certainly the Department of Homeland Security is preparing for, looks like, riots. And certainly the cut food stamp programs and possibly also protest over the Obamacare and loss of insurance that millions are experiencing. Clearly the federal government is preparing for riots when the tax season rolls around in April.
Okay, Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry Corsi writes for WorldNet Daily, WND.com. Email in from Jason. Listen to this one. George, I've got a brother. He's serving time in a federal penitentiary. And according to his inside prison info from two different sources, he claims a wife of the prison guard who runs a sign-making company here in the U.S. has been printing up signs with martial law all last month and this month. This has been the only thing that they're working on. He also mentioned another guard stated that a police officer pulled over a big rig that seemed to be overweight on a highway in Kentucky. and that all that was inside the semi, signs that said martial law. I was only hoping you might read this to Coast to Coast listeners to see if anyone else might have some inside info on what the heck is going on or is ready to go down. Isn't that interesting? Tied into all these other stories, then the email makes a little more sense. Americans who believe marijuana should remain illegal are now in the minority, according to new polls. For the first time ever in a Gallup poll, a clear majority of the country, 58%, say that pot should be legalized. That figure represents an increase of 10 percentage points since last year. Look, if you have a dog, specifically somewhat of a cat, take heed to this story. Nearly 600 pets have died. More than 3,600 have been sickened in an ongoing mysterious outbreak of illnesses tied to jerky treats made in China. Most of the cases have been dogs of all breeds, ages, sizes, although 10 cats have been sickened too after eating chicken, duck, and sweet potato jerky treats. The pace of the reported illnesses appear to have slowed, but the Federal Food and Drug Administration officials are now seeking extra help from vets and pet owners and trying to solve the ongoing puzzle. The new numbers are up from 500 deaths and 3,200 illnesses in January. And some of the treats, of course, most of them recalled. Nestle, Purina, Pet Care Companies, Wagon Train, and Canyon Creek Ranch Treats, Del Monte Corp's Milo's Kitchen Chicken Jerky, and Chicken Grillers Homestyle Dog Treats simply resulted in this situation. So just be careful. You know, we love animals, and we want you to take care of yours. Singer Noel Harrison has died at his home in England, 79 years old, the son of the late great actor Rex Harrison. He was best known for recording that hit song, The Windmills of Your Mind. It was the best song at the 1968 Oscars in the movie The Thomas Crown Affair and was later covered by artists including Dusty Springfield. Harrison spent much of his life in America as an actor and performer, moved back to the UK in the last decade. Noel Harrison dead at the age of 79. As we reported yesterday, spanking may leave a lasting impact on children well past their initial punishment. Children who were spanked often early in life by their mothers were more likely to be aggressive later in childhood compared to kids who weren't spanked at all, according to a study published in Pediatrics. And being spanked by dads was also linked to vocabulary and language problems in kids. It's a story that baffled me, so I thought I'd check in with our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Bragan. Peter, what's this one all about?
Well, two different things. First, there's no doubt that spanking is not good for kids, but you're probably baffled by these high rates of spanking. And the study itself talks about that spanking, this is their conclusion, spanking remains a typical rearing experience for American children. But who are they studying? If you go to a website separate from this, do some more research, you find out that this is a poverty group of inner city people. The cohort, which is, this is not in the article, 75% were born to unmarried mothers.
Mm, okay.
75% are black and Hispanic. They're all from major cities around the country. So what's going on here in part is that we're looking again at the tragedy of inner city America, both the amount of brutality within the family and, of course, some of the things that go into producing violence in the inner cities of America, which is spanking. But I'm sure there are so many other variables in this group that is in such a tragic condition in the country. And what struck me the most about this is that the authors of the study are either being politically correct or they thought they wouldn't get any publicity if they mentioned who were the folks in their study, because in both the introduction to the study and its conclusion, they give the impression that these are a typical American culture children from typical American culture.
But I would assume, Peter, that, you know, if a family in suburbia had a kid and they spanked the heck out of him, would this still happen to him?
Yes, and thank you for bringing me back to that very important point. Yes, spanking is not good for kids. And, you know, these parents are reporting spanking more than twice a week of three-year-olds and even spanking infants. So, no, this is not good for children at all. It tends to convince kids, of course, that violence is a way of resolving conflicts, and you just have to wait till you're big enough to inflict violence.
Exactly. And, Peter, you know what it is, too? It's a bigger person bullying a little person who can't fight back. And then, obviously, when they grow up, they're all screwed up. Peter, thanks again. Dr. Peter Brigham, his website is linked up to our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. You'll find that, by the way, all our news guests that you hear popping in and popping out, all their links are part of our Twitter feed. The main guests, the hour guests, like Robert Zimmerman, who I'll introduce in just a second, and, of course, Michael Rivero next hour, they're all linked up on the website at coasttocoastam.com. Intensive exercise improves the academic performance of teenagers, according to new research. A study of about 5,000 children found links between exercise and exam success in English, math, and science. How about that? Microsoft preparing to launch its own version of Google Glass by developing their own wearable smartware. This is the latest instance where the tech giant is putting itself in direct competition with Google. Apple unveiling a lighter iPad. It's called the iPad Air. It weighs 1 pound, 20% thinner, 28% lighter than the current fourth generation iPad. They'll probably sell a million of them. Prices start at $499 and go up to $629 if you're interested. And the number of observed exoplanets, world circling distant stars, has now passed 1,000. Of those, they say 12 could be habitable, orbiting at a distance where it is neither too hot nor too cold for water to be liquid on the surface. The planets are given away by tiny dips in light as they pass in front of their stars. And we're going to jump in with Robert Zimmerman in a moment. BehindTheBlack.com is his website. His book, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8. And we'll get his take on this science story next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Zimmerman with me this hour as we're going to talk about all things space and science this hour. We'll take your calls, too. And, of course, we're talking about the exoplanet tally soaring above 1,000 planets now. Robert, you know, when I was a kid, I've mentioned the story a couple times. I would tell my science teacher that this universe was loaded with planets, and he'd say, "We've never found any other outside of our solar system. How do you know that?" And I said, "Because it's the same everywhere." And I was right. Here we are.
Well, you know, George, the argument I always heard when I was a kid many years ago was that there are just so many stars out there. Statistically, there's got to be lots of planets. What's interesting in the reality of finally seeing planets, discovering them, is that they're not what we expected. They're in places in solar systems we didn't expect, you know, very, very close to the stars. They're bigger. Jupiter is close to the stars. They never expected that. They're finding them in combinations and arrangements that just not were predicted. And that's just the wonder of the universe. You know, it's always a surprise. Something's always going to be there that's unknown. The 1,000 that are known right now, there are a lot of them that might end up to be non-exoplanets. What I think is more interesting is the something like 2,000 potential exoplanets that Kepler had found,
yes,
that have not yet been confirmed as planets. Those potential transits have to be checked in by in other manners with other telescopes, and they haven't. It can take years to do that. We don't have the facilities to do them all at once. And I would say it wouldn't be surprising if at least half of those end up to be some form of exoplanet. And so there alone, you've doubled the number, or come close to it. And of course, this is only scratching the surface. I mean, we've only just begun doing this kind of research. So the universe is Jeff Marcy, who was one of the very first guys to discover an exoplanet, once said this to me. This is back when I was writing an article for Astronomy on exoplanets back about a decade ago. He said to me, it is his firm belief that every single star out there, not in a binary system, every single star has exoplanets.
I think he's right. This primordial soup that I would call the laws of physics in nature, it works everywhere in the universe. It's all the same. I don't know how it works, but that's what happens.
Well, you know, funny, what you just said is would apply to every other astronomer and scientist in the world, in a sense. They are discovering enormous amounts of data, but they still are only scratching the surface. They really don't know how it works. They have theories which fit the present facts about how, you know, solar systems form out of the nebula of a star. But the detail work here is very nebulous, to pun intended, at this moment in time.
Robert, as you look at all things space these days, what's out there that really is exciting you right now?
George, I've been on Coast to Coast now a lot this year.
A lot.
About the same thing over and over again, and it has to be the competition to get private enterprise into space.
Yeah. Right
now. That's what gets me excited more than anything else. There's lots of good scientific research, you know, the stuff on Mars with the rovers and the orbiters, you know, Cassini around Saturn, that's really exciting. Juno on the way to Pluto, you have Messenger and Mercury and Venus Express at Venus, and you got New Horizons heading to Pluto. So there's tons of, you know, science research going on. Hubble's still working. There's tons of astronomy. But what really gets me going, gets my socks rolling up and down, you might say, in excitement, is the competition for private space, because it's going to open up the heavens for everybody, and it's going. And it's the kind of thing that when I was a little kid in the 60s, the culture of America kind of expected this kind of thing to happen. And then somehow the culture of America changed, and for the last 40, 50 years, we didn't have that. And now suddenly we're having it again, and I think it's glorious, and it's just I cannot tell you how exciting it is to me. I mean, you know, for example, today, George, the Cygnus cargo craft that Orbital Sciences built for NASA for pennies on the dollar in only like 3.5-4 years, it undocked from ISS.
Amazing.
Completing its mission. It's going to deorbit, burn up over the Pacific tomorrow. It's filled with garbage right now. But that completes its first test demo mission, 100% successful. No problems of any significance. They had one slight software glitch at the very beginning, which was not a big deal, and they just simply rescheduled the docking to later, and it worked like a dream. And so now the United States, in less than 5 years, has developed, for really very little money, about what they spend per year on the space launch system that NASA's trying to build, for a total what they spent, about $3 billion, we have two different ways with two different rockets and two different capsules to get cargo to low Earth orbit to ISS.
But that's exciting.
It's incredibly exciting. And now on top of that, the United States is developing three different ways to get humans into orbit with three different crafts by three different companies. And just as with Cygnus and with Dragon, the vehicles, the technology belongs to the companies, so they can sell it to others. Dragon was launched on a Falcon 9. This is something that happened just like 2.5-3 weeks ago. SpaceX launched its upgraded Falcon 9 rocket for its first commercial launch. And this was they had done a major engineering redesign of the Falcon 9 rocket. And to be able to do this while doing commercial launches is the kind of thing that private companies do. NASA wouldn't do this. They couldn't take the chance, and they would be slow, and they'd be careful, and they would do tests, and it would cost a fortune. Private company can't afford that. They've got to do it well, and they've got to do it fast. And so while they're making their launches, they redesigned Falcon 9, and then on a commercial launch, they launched it. It has bigger tanks. It's 60% I think 60% longer, so the tanks have more fuel. It has a reconfigured, a redesigned, upgraded engine.
I mean, it's great science, Robert. We're going to come back in a moment. I want to ask you about life out there. We'll be back as we rage through the night on Coast to Coast AM. Getting lots of emails about that email I read about the martial law signs being made by the prisoner guard's wife. It's an email. I don't even know if it's real. That's what he said was going on. I want you to tuck that away. And welcome back to Coast, Bob Zimmerman with us, of course. And Bob, before we go to calls, as we all agree, we probably have got millions, if not billions, of planets out there. Many of them have the capability of being habitable. Do you believe that there's intelligent life out there?
It would surprise me if there aren't, but I would also add that we have had the capability of detecting some intelligent sounds from other species now for almost a half century and have come up empty, which is a puzzling fact. If there was other intelligent life out there, their radio signals should be flitting around the galaxy, George, and they haven't been. We haven't picked anything up, and we should have.
Maybe they've been here.
Well, even if they have, we're sophisticated enough to have picked up their radio signals from any civilization that's out there. You know, TV started around 1950, and the television frequency broadcasts, they don't just go from place to place. They go out into space. And so they've now traveled 50 light years, a bubble, 50 light years around our whole solar system. Well, the same thing would apply to other civilizations that might be millions of years old. So it's puzzling that we've picked nothing up. So that's just the mystery of that we're faced with at the moment. If you look at from other perspectives, the number of stars and the number of exoplanets, it suggests that the odds of there being no other life in this vast array of stars seems impossible. And at the same time, a study of the Earth's development over time suggests that there's a lot of potholes along the way that could destroy life. For example, recent studies, I posted this on Behind the Black, suggest that as the sun has rotated in the galaxy, as it passes through the various spiral arms, the environment there is more hostile, and those passages seem to align with previous extinction events. So who knows? I don't know at the moment. That's the fact. That's science. We don't know. And the fact is there's a mystery here that requires more research. It seems impossible that there's no other life, to sum it up. But at this moment in time, after a half century of sophisticated space science, not having detected anything is beginning to be a mystery.
All right, to the phones we go. We've got Bob Zimmerman for this hour. Let's go to Tim in Racine, Wisconsin to get things going. Hey, Tim, thanks for calling.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, Timmy.
George, I got a question for Bob.
Okay.
Comet Ison. I would like to know, where can we see it at certain times in the night, you know, at what times, where, you know, when?
Tim, do you want to do this with a telescope or with your naked eye?
Well, I'm going to buy a telescope, so, I mean, will I be able to see it with a telescope even?
It sure will.
It's absolutely visible by telescope. The comet itself at this moment in time continues to underperform. And
it may disintegrate, Bob.
It may disintegrate as it passes by the sun. Some scientists say the data they have suggests no, but we really don't know at the moment. I can't off the top of my head tell you where to look. I'm sorry. It's not something I have in the top of my head. If you do searches on the web, depending on where you live, there are almost always amateur astronomy clubs in the area, and those people would trip over themselves to help you, tell you where it is and when you can look. And I would do some Google searches on the
web. And we give updates, Bob, almost weekly with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. He's a, you know, he's an astronomer. And we give updates on where Comet Ison is, and we explain where you can see it and how you can see it. So we'll do that, too.
Yeah, and the, to me, the interesting thing about it is that it's underperforming. Comets are very unreliable. Don't bank on them. They do what they want to do, and it was spotted so far away that it suggested it could be really, really bright, but it's just not turning out that way at this moment.
No, it is not. Okay, hey, thanks, Tim, for your call. Appreciate it. Next up, we move on to Don in Salem, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Don, you're on with Bob Zimmerman. Go ahead.
Hello, guys. Boy, this is serendipity because Comet Ison is in the northwest, just over the top of Mars. And my question is, Robert, what happened to Mars? Did the core just die out, or did it get hit with something? And I'll listen to you on the radio.
All right, great. That's always a great question. Mars died. How did it happen?
Well, the fundamental thing about what they think with Mars is that it's a smaller planet. And because it has a lighter gravity, it's about a third the Earth's, a little less than a third, its atmosphere just essentially over time escaped. And the consequence of that is the planet dried up. That's the basic theory today, what caused Mars to become a dead planet. All the evidence we're gathering so far suggests that it started out with many of the same possibilities as Earth: water, atmosphere, an environment that conceivably could have had life. But the fact that the planet is so light, it doesn't have as much mass as the Earth, allowed its atmosphere to dribble away and eventually for the planet to dry up. That's at least the theories are presently stated.
How's your book, Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, doing?
It's doing great. It's available now as an e-book. To me, that's that moment in time. It's the 60s. It's big space. It's NASA, the government, making it happen. But the thing that I always think about that mission, the Apollo 8 mission to the moon, is that they decided to go, George, thinking the odds were good for success, believing that the odds were 50-50. They decided to go on that mission thinking the odds were good, and they believed the odds were 50-50, that they had a 50% chance of dying, and those were good odds in their minds. It was this is the kind of thing that I think Americans should look up to and emulate: the willingness to take great risks to achieve great things. And that's why I wrote the book. And to me, in my mind, it's still – and when you take great risks like that, the result is you shake the world. You change things. And I think this was an example of that.
In August, I was at a speaking engagement. It was called Contact in the Desert. Of course, we're talking about contact and UFOs.
Yes.
And it was one of the first times, Robert, I was able to get away from – city lights.
Uh-huh.
This was way out in Joshua Tree, and at night, looking up at the sky, you saw the most incredible array of stars I have ever seen in my life. It has been a long time. I've been on a couple cruises, and I used to, go out on a paddle boat with my uncle. He owned a camp in Massachusetts, and that was pretty. I couldn't remember what it was like to see a sky with so many stars, with no light distractions from cities. It's unbelievable. There are zillions up there.
That you're understating the number. tragically today, most Americans live in an environment where they don't get an opportunity to nonchalantly see the sky. When I was a child, my parents would take me. We lived in New York City, but every summer we would go up to a what they called a bungalow colony in the Catskills. It was basically a place where you rent a cottage and you spend the summer in the forest, in the country. And I was 5 years old, and we would go up there, and I got to see the sky routinely as it normally, as it is.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Milky Way. And the Milky Way, you know, people, it's really incredible to see. And that's the sad thing. I live now in Tucson, Arizona, where, you know, the skies are dark. I can drive like literally 2 minutes from my house, and I can look up and see those black skies.
It's amazing. I saw also what looked like gas clouds in the night sky up there.
Where were you in Joshua Tree?
But it wasn't. They were. Somebody told me that they were stars even farther away.
I mean, if you're in the southern hemisphere, you'd see the Magellanic Clouds, which are similar to the Milky Way, but they're smaller galaxies farther away. I'm not sure what you were seeing here in Joshua Tree. If you see, for example, Andromeda, the galaxy Andromeda.
Yeah.
What people don't realize is how really large it is in the sky. You could put like three or four moons across its length. And I didn't realize that until I went to a star party of amateur astronomers, and they pointed it out to me. And you'd look in the telescope, but then you'd look at the sky itself, and it's very faint without a telescope. But when you realize where to look, and you look closely, and the sky's dark enough, and your eyes are adapted, you suddenly can see it. And that one galaxy, you know, it's big. Think about three or four moons next to each other. That's not small in the sky. And this is a galaxy, the nearest large galaxy. So your skies might have been that good that you were seeing these things and didn't realize it.
That's amazing. Let's go next. East. David's in Oklahoma. Hey, Dave, go ahead.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, sir. You sure are.
Yes. How are you doing this evening?
Good, David. Hope you are, too.
I wanted to speak with you fellows about a man named Lloyd Pye. I'm sure you probably heard of him.
I know Lloyd. How's he doing? Because he's been getting some treatments, and we haven't heard lately.
I was about to ask you the same question.
As a matter of fact, Tom is going to be checking on that. We just talked about that 2 days ago.
Really?
Lloyd's been a regular guest here. We think the world out of him. He went out of the country for some special cancer treatments.
Oh, me.
But we'll get you an update on that.
Good. Yeah, you know, when I got on the internet, I watched one of his videos. It was entitled "Everything You Know Is Wrong."
Yes,
and that fascinated me because I believe in God and whatnot. And I'm not going to go into religion. You know, that's a touchy subject to a lot of people. But anyway, I believe that life here on Earth is unique. Now, whether or not we were created by aliens, or we were created by God, or God created the aliens and the aliens created us.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But I kind of think that sometimes, though, if we want to look for life outside of our own solar system, we need to just do exactly that. Stay inside of our own solar system. I mean, because if you think about it, the chances of finding life, we need to look no further on than our own solar system. I didn't articulate that.
Well, there's probably some here too, but you know, let's assume we all believe in God or this intelligent design.
Okay.
I'm a believer that there's life everywhere. I don't think that this intelligent designer just made it here.
I'm in agreement with you.
Yeah,
there.
It's everywhere, and that, Robert, I think keeps us pushing, because here's the big question: going to the moon, developing a Mars program, building the Hubble, and doing all the incredible things we have done in space. What are we trying to find out?
You've just described the fundamental reason I named my website Behind the Black. When the first astronauts got to the moon, and they were looking at the, you know, they were on the surface, and you saw these pictures of these guys walking around, and above them is this black sky, totally black. And because it's daylight there, you really can't see. It's not because of the atmosphere. There's no atmosphere. But because of the brightness, you can't see the stars. So what you see is a blackness. And what humans do is we want to know what's behind that black. And that's where I got my name of my website.
What's behind the black?
And this first generation, last half century of space exploration has given us our first glimpse of what's out there behind the black. And it is always, always more spectacular, mysterious, amazing than we can imagine. And that's what gets me psyched all the time, George, all the time.
Let's go to Garrett in Puyallup, Washington. Welcome to the show, Garrett. We'll get you in. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Robert.
Hi.
I have a question. Growing up and believing Pluto is still a planet, we have a mindset of a horizontal solar system. Why isn't there more on a vertical aspect of a third or fourth, fifth dimension on the axis of our solar system?
That's a good question.
In all our studies, what's up there, up and down versus left and right?
Well, that's a really good question. When solar systems form, it's like you spin a disk. If you spin it, the material in the cloud is going to eventually move itself into the central disk, the equator. That's just the natural process. And so that's where the planets are going to form as a general rule. And that's where you're going to get the bulk of the material. That's at least as present theories exist. Now, that's going to be in the inner solar system, which is where all the planets are presently exist. But the outer nebulous, it's less controlled by that spin. And so you're going to have more objects above and below the ecliptic, the equator of the sun. And that's where you have the Oort cloud, which is like almost a light year out, which is where the comets supposedly come from. And they can come from almost any direction, the 360 degrees, not just along the ecliptic, because there is material scattered about there. It's one of the reasons as you move out, Pluto is not, is its orbit is slightly tilted. The farther out you go, the more tilts you're going to see because they're less controlled by that initial orbital spin of the cloud that forced the planets to form on the ecliptic. Now, because of the fact that you can get objects all over the place, and it's difficult to look in all 360-degree directions, there could be big asteroids and big comets up there that we don't know about that could hit the Earth, and we haven't been able to track them yet because they're coming from all directions.
Let's take one or two more calls. Brian in Houston, Texas. Brian, let's squeeze you in here. Go ahead.
All right, I got a quick one. Robert, I'm wondering, you said, you know, we haven't picked up any signals. I'm wondering, do you embrace the possibility that, you know, physics will let them have a different technology that, you know, we might not be aware of
great
yet?
Great question.
It's a great question. And in fact, we ourselves might be beginning to develop in that direction. I mentioned television broadcasts started around 1950. But, you know, we're moving away from broadcast and moving into a computerized system of transmitting information. That's all by wire. It wouldn't broadcast. And so over time, a more sophisticated civilization might not actually broadcast that much, and it might not be intentional. They might not be trying to hide anything. Like, we're not trying to really hide anything right now. It's just that the technologies have moved us in a direction where we don't broadcast as much. It's not the best way to get information. Who watches free TV nowadays? You know, you're all on cable, or we're having, you know, Netflix streamed into our home over telephone lines. So, you know, optics. And that doesn't get picked up anywhere else. So it's very possible just simple technology, which isn't so alien or advanced that we're actually doing today, could explain this.
Robert, you're exciting with space, my friend. Robert's website, behindtheblack.com. Go ahead and take a look at that. I'm coming back in a moment here on Coast to Coast with Michael Rivera.